on the triennial Torah portion readings for the week, which consists of Deuteronomy, Jeremiah 3, verses 1 and 2, Psalm 127, and Ephesians chapter 2, continuing on to chapter 3 and verse 6. Let's begin then in Deuteronomy in chapter 9. Verse 1, Hear, O Israel, you are to pass over Jordan this day to go in to possess nations greater and mightier than yourself, cities great and fenced up to heaven, a people great and tall, the children of the Anakims, whom you know and whom you have heard say, Who can stand before the children of Anak? Understand, therefore, this day that Yahweh your Elohim, it is He which goes over before you as a consuming fire. He shall destroy them, and He shall bring them down before your face. So shall you drive them out and destroy them quickly, as Yahweh has said unto you. Speak not in your heart after that Yahweh your Elohim has cast them out from before you, saying, For my righteousness, the Lord has brought me in to possess this land, but for the wickedness of these nations, Yahweh has driven them out from before you. Nor for my righteousness or for the uprightness of your heart do you go to possess the land, but for the wickedness of these nations, Yahweh your Elohim does drive them out from before you, that He may perform the word which He swore unto your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We'll stop there with the thoughts, questions, comments. Within the congregation, or in Pow Talk land. Now, if you're in Pow Talk land and you have a thought, question, comment, and you have a mic, then please put up your hand, and we'll try our best to give you an opportunity to come to the mic and share your thought, questions, comment. Otherwise, you can always text your thought, question, or comment, and we'll be able to follow along and keep connected that way. And so Mark want me to read verse 6 as well before we have our thoughts, questions, comments, which says, Understand therefore that the Lord your God gives you not this good land to possess it for your righteousness, for you are a stiff-necked people. All right, here we are. We'll open the floor.
The reason I wanted that
thoughts,
is because
questions, comments.
The reason I wanted that is because that is the end of the paragraph in the King James, and it also is in the Tanakh, in the Torah portion. So I thought it would be a good idea to read the whole thing. Where am I? That's the wrong page. Here we go. Verses 4 through 6. I got plenty of personal commentary on that, but I wanted to read something from the Chumash. This is probably the only thing I'll read out of here today. It says, do not say in your heart, it's talking about, don't think that you're going in there because you're righteous and that you're worthy. Okay, you're not going in there because you're worthy. You're going in there because, number one, the Amorites have fulfilled their iniquity. Like I promised Abraham back in chapter 15 of Genesis. He said, your people will be 400 years in captivity waiting for the Amorites' iniquities to be full. When that happens, then they'll come into the land. Well, now the 400 years are up, and now they're going into the land. So that's one thing, because he told Abraham when it would be. He also promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all that they would be given. And so it wasn't the people that were going in that were so good, it was Yahweh keeping His word. Twice keeping His word. So that's what that's all for. But here's and that's pretty much what Rashi has to say. Rashi says, do not think that you will triumph because of a combination of your righteousness and Canaanite wickedness. Your righteousness is not sufficient to be a factor at all. Instead, you will conquer because of Canaanite wickedness and because of God's oath to the patriarchs. That's what Rashi said. The Rambam said this. In verse 4, Moses said, Do not think that your righteousness will win for you. Instead, it is the wickedness of the Canaanites that is causing them to be driven out. Thus, Rambam renders the word, and I'm not going to try to read it, as but because of the wickedness. In verse 5, Moses reiterates that the Jews should not think that their righteousness is sufficient. If so, Moses should answer another question. Even though the Canaanites deserve to be displaced, why should Israel have the privilege of succeeding them? To that, he answers that the oath of the patriarchs was still in effect. Now, here's what I really wanted to get to, because this just contradicts everything that's already been said. It says, although Moses had said above in verses chapter 7 and verse 8 that God loves Israel, which is a clear, and this is the thing that contradicts, which is a clear indication that the nation must be worthy of such love. That statement referred only to the nation in its totality. This says that they are righteous enough to be worthy of the love of God? I'm sorry, folks. I'm sorry, folks, but none is righteous. Not one. No one is worthy of the love of God. God gives the love because of his mercy, not because of our having merited it. That's what grace is unmerited favor, correct? We have his favor because we did not merit it. We have his favor because he gave it, even though we didn't merit it. Okay, so that's... Never did, never will. So, Israel gets the land due to one fact, Yahweh's grace. They no more merit this favor than we do. Genesis 15:16 says, if Israel fills her... look at Genesis 15:16, where it talks about the Amorites filling their iniquity. If Israel fills, they'll also be taken out of the land, because this land is not theirs. This land is Yahweh's. The reason that the Amorites are being thrown out is they defiled it. It's Yahweh's land, and the Amorites have defiled it. If Israel defiles the land, believe me, same thing is going to happen. And guess what? It did. And guess what else, folks? Because we've defiled our land, we're going to be thrown out of it. Time for us to repent as a group. And to repent individually. That's all I got, Eddie. I'm off the soapbox now.
You have anything you'd like to share?
I think it's interesting here that the Anakims aren't they the descendants of Achan that where the giants came from?
Yes.
So
yes.
This is another eruption of what's
yes.
of what was taking
in,
place in Genesis.
Two of
Yeah, chapter 2 talks about it too. And so we know that they would have defiled the land. And he says in chapter 4 that these people, basically he's telling them, you know what, you're on an ego trip. You're making, I'm a self-made man, I'm a whatever, you know, that I'm righteous, that's why we're going into the land. And he does point out here, you know, because of the wickedness of these nations and the nations of people that are in the land, that he said that he's going to do that. And that's the only reason. And he says it twice. It's a double witness of the fact. It's not you. It's not you that matters. What matters is my promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Correct.
That's why they're going into the land.
Amen.
And, you know, they're not the best of people, but he has to use what he has left after. You figure, got you in the wilderness for 40 years.
Yeah.
You know, things haven't changed much, you know. But he does say he's the one that's going to do it. And if you go to Joshua, if you flip to Joshua, you'll see that in the land of Israel, he did remove these giants. But not in Gaza and the other places that tells you there. They were removed out of the land that they were supposed to occupy, but not Gaza and so forth there. So these people have to realize, why was it done? Because of the other people's wickedness. And I'm going to keep my word. Because he will not lie. Yahweh will not lie. That's what I see here.
I'd like to look at this from a personal spiritual application. Because We're looking at this through the literal natural, which is valid and appropriate, but ultimately it has a spiritual meaning and application. And we need to remember that much of the Torah is about explaining the children of Israel coming out of Egypt and the generation that left Egypt and their the things that happened to them in the wilderness. And coming out of Egypt and on a journey to the Promised Land is a personal walk that we're all called unto, that Egypt represents the world and the world system. Coming out at Passover represents putting the blood of Yeshua upon our hearts and our lives and receiving the forgiveness of his sins by grace through faith. And we're told in Exodus in chapter 3 and verse 12, this will be a token unto you when I've sent you, that when you've brought forth the people out of Egypt, you will serve God on this mountain. That he brings us out of Egypt, the world and the world system, which is a purchase. He buys us. When we commit our, when we give our lives to the Almighty, he buys us, and we are called to his service and to do his will. And ultimately, what he has called us to do, the fullness of what he has purposed and called us to do, that we cannot complete it and accomplish it in our own ability. That where he is taking us is a place of giants, which means in the natural world, the natural circumstances and natural logic opposes you. That the promised land is a place where natural circumstances and natural logic opposes what you're being told to do. And because the natural circumstances and natural logic opposes you, they are the giants that you're not able to overcome in your own ability. It is only through Yah fighting your battles for you that you'll be able to do it. But ultimately, and you seeking to serve him, in the end, it's not because he that you deserve for his goodness to be upon your life. It is because of his faithfulness and to accomplish his plan and his purposes for the benefit of his kingdom that he acts on our behalf. And so this is an eternal spiritual principle of Yah's kingdom. So when you're living your life, have discernment to recognize this when it comes. So the promised land and going into the promised land represents receiving and walking in our harvest, our Sukkot, if you want to see it and look at it and understand it in that way. That Sukkot is associated with the completion of the task. The promised land is going in and taking that land and possessing it, fulfilling what the Almighty has called you to do. So what happened when the tabernacle got completed? It says in Exodus in chapter 40 and verse 34 that the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Now, what happened when Solomon completed and dedicated the first temple? In 1 Kings and chapter 8, we see a detailed account of this. And then we see what happens In the parallel account, in 2 Chronicles, and chapter 5, this chapter is as well about Solomon bringing up the temple. And we see here the following, that in 2 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 14, the priest could not stand to minister by reason of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord had filled the house of God. Okay? So I want you to see that the dedication of this temple represents a completion of a journey, a completion of a task, a fulfillment of a task, which is associated with coming out of Egypt in the promised land, is associated with going in and taking that land to complete the task. That when the task got completed in 2 Chronicles chapter 5 verse 13, this is what was said from the voice of those who were there. It says, it came to pass as the trumpeters and the singers were as one to make one sound to be heard in praising and thanking the Lord. And when they lifted up their voice with trumpets and cymbals and instruments and music and praised Yahweh, saying, now this is the phrase I want you to catch, for he is good and his mercy endures forever. He is good and his mercy endures forever. In other words, when he does it, even though you're being his servant, you're seeking to follow his ways, but in truth, you're still fleshly. You still fail. So therefore, you don't deserve it. It's not because of your righteousness. It's because of his covenant promise. And so when he fulfills it, the joy of it causes one to feel like that you express nothing but gratitude unto him. And this is represented by the phrase, Yahweh is good and his mercy endures forever. We are reminded of Psalm chapter 44 and verse 3, which tells us about going in to the land. It says, they got not the land in possession by their own sword, neither did their own arm save them, but your right hand and your arm, because you had favor upon them. You see, whenever you are in ministry, whenever you are, Sunday school teacher, or in whatever capacity that you're in ministry and service to the Lord, maybe you're organizing an event. But if you are thinking that I'm saying God needs me, and that I'm something for the kingdom, then you are not going to be able to go fully in where Yah is calling you, because the one who he takes is the one who realizes that he, and he's completely dependent upon Yah. And Yah's the one that's got to fight his battles and defeat his enemies, and not because of my power and my might. But the part of the reason why he gives you a promised land is because those in the world are wicked. Mm-hmm. And he's removing them out of their place, and he's giving that land to you. Mm-hmm. Because of the wickedness of the land. You know, reminds me, I was my first year in college. There was an opportunity to work at UPS. And all that they asked was for a seasonal help, which they often need in November and December to handle the increased package load. But I was told by those who work there after a year that they bring in this seasonal help, and the probability of anyone who got brought in to seasonal help to keep is very low. And so I wasn't looking at the situation from my own ability and the confidence in me. I was looking at the situation through being a servant of the Almighty. And so I prayed this prayer to the Almighty, you know, rather than somebody to stay in and work there after the end of the season, temporary hiring that doesn't believe in you, that doesn't follow your ways. In other words, an uncircumcised Philistine. Allow someone to be blessed that is a follower of you. So, because my trust and my confidence was in him, not in me, because the reason why I prayed the prayer is because I saw that in myself, looking at myself, I felt weak. But in him, I feel strong. And so there were, I forget, there was either 23 or 25 temporary workers that they hired in November and December. This was in Columbus. And at the end of December, when 1st of January comes, they only kept two. Two of the 23 or two of the 25. And I was one of the two. And so what do I attribute that to? I only attribute it to one thing, the favor of God, the grace of God, and that he is good and his mercy endures forever. I don't attribute that to anything about me and my ability and whatever. It's his favor. And so that's how you got to, that's the perspective that you need to know and understand and realize when Yah is leading and guiding and directing your life, that he wants to take you to a land of giants, but he needs, and he wants to show his faithfulness to you. However, at the same time, he wants you to understand that your victory is not because of your merit. Even though you're a servant and you're seeking to do his will, it is because of his mercy. It is because of his, to fulfill his plans and purposes. It's for the benefit and the glory of his kingdom. And as long as you keep an attitude of humbling yourself and allow yourself to be used for the benefit and the glory of his kingdom, he will continue to bless you. But if you take upon the glory to yourself like you deserve it, like Hasatan did when he rebelled, then the giants of the land are so great, he'll let the giants eat you up. So that's the spiritual principle that I wanted to share regarding the first six verses. Anybody else want to share regarding the first six verses before we go on? You have anything, Mark, or you? We got to go to verse 7.
Yeah, I got something. This group of people that's coming into the promised land. Only two of them came out of Egypt as adults, okay, Joshua and Caleb. All the rest were under 20 when they crossed the Jordan or the Red Sea. It had been 40 years, give or take a few days. It was 40 years that these people had been trusting Yahweh for everything. Their food was coming from him. Their water was following them around. The rock that followed them, and that rock was Messiah, was the one that was providing them water, okay, all throughout the wilderness, according to the rabbis. That particular thing, I think I probably go with. The rock followed them around. The fact is that they were being provided for by Yahweh all the way through for 40 years. These people did not remember, at least they didn't remember very well, living any other way. They didn't have an idea of the government taking care of them. They knew that Yahweh would take care of them. They may have eaten some meat every once in a while, but if they other than quail, if they ate anything, it was their own flock that they were eating from.
So a whole generation went into the promised land that knew nothing but their
right.
Livelihood depended upon trusting in him.
Exactly right. And these are the people that Yahweh is bringing into the land. All right? And they now have been trusting him for 40 years. Whether or not they've been trusting him spiritually, they have been trusting him physically for 40 years. They had got nothing. They didn't raise their own crops. They probably didn't eat a lot of their own flocks. The flocks were mainly used for sacrifice, I would think. But, They got quail in the evening. They got manna in the morning. They got all the food that they needed, and all the water that they needed from Yahweh. Everything that they had to have to live, they got from Yah. He let their clothes wear out. He didn't let the bottoms of their shoes wear out. He didn't let their feet get sore. Okay, when they had to move, they moved. And I mean, it was total reliance on Him. If any person was ever, if any group of people rather, was ever prepared for going over and trusting Yahweh to give them the land, it was these. It was these. Okay? And so he's now the land has been defiled. It's up to them to go into this land, not only to take it back for Yahweh, but and this is what they did as they went through. They were cleansing the land as they went through as well. This is an amazing group of people that are coming in here. As wicked and as stiff-necked as they were still an amazing people that were coming through here. And it's the kind of trust that we need to be seeing in our own lives as well, not just reading about it in the scriptures. Is everybody doing okay? I've been in the room here for about 10 minutes, and there's nothing going on except for Servant 60 said I'm well. Oh, yeah, Eretz Israel. Okay, so the people in this room are in there, okay. And Servant 60 is in, but anybody else out there, can you at least give me a one? Let me know that you're alive. There you go.
Hey, okay. We at least got one person.
We do have enough. To hear that. All right, here we go. All right, here we go. All right, listen. You have heard so far everybody that's in this room, Bill and Eddie and me. We need some help. So y'all got anything? Raise your hand and let us know. All right?
Okay, verse 7. Remember and forget not how you provoked Yahweh your Elohim to wrath in the wilderness from the day that you did depart out of the land of Egypt until you came unto this place. You've been rebellious against Yahweh. Also in Horeb you provoked Yahweh to wrath, so that Yahweh was angry with you to have destroyed you. When I was gone up into the mount to receive the tables of the covenant which Yahweh made with you, then I abode in the mount 40 days and 40 nights. I neither did eat bread nor drink water. And Yahweh delivered unto me 2 tables of stone written with the finger of God. And on them was written according to all the words which Yahweh spake in you in the mount, out of the midst of the fire, in the day of the assembly. And it came to pass at the end of 40 days and 40 nights that Yahweh gave me the 2 tablets of stone, even the covenant. And Yahweh said unto me, arise, get you down quickly from here, for your people which have you brought forth out of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have quickly turned aside out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten image. Furthermore, Yahweh spake unto me, saying, I have seen this people, and behold, it's a stiff-necked people. Let me alone, that I may blot out their name from under heaven. I'll make of you a nation mightier and greater than they. So I turned and came down from the mount, and the mount burned with fire, and the 2 tables of the covenant were in my 2 hands. And I looked, and behold, you had sinned against Yahweh your Elohim, and made you a golden calf. You had turned aside quickly out of the way which Yahweh had commanded you. And I took the 2 tables, cast them out of my 2 hands, and broke them before your eyes. And I fell down before Yahweh as at the first 40 days and 40 nights. I did neither eat bread nor drink water because of all your sins which you had sinned in doing wickedly in the sight of Yahweh to provoke him to anger. Notice this is a second 40-day and 40-night period. For I was afraid of the anger and hot displeasure wherewith brought against you.
With but a couple of hours in between, it looks like.
To destroy you. But Yahweh hearkened unto me at that time also. And Yahweh was very angry with Aaron to have destroyed him. And I prayed for Aaron also the same time. And I took your sin. I took your sin. The calf which you made, and I burned it with fire, and stamped it and ground it very small, and even until it was as small as the dust, and I cast the dust thereof into the brook that descended out of the mount. And at Taberah, and at Massah, and at Kibrot Hattava, you provoked Yahweh to wrath. Likewise, when Yahweh sent you to Kadesh Barnea, saying, go to possess the land which I have given you, then you rebelled against the commandments of Yahweh, your Elohim, not nor hearkened to his voice. You've been rebellious against Yahweh from the day that I knew you. Thus I fell down before Yahweh 40 days and 40 nights, as I fell down at the first, because Yahweh had said he would destroy you. I prayed therefore unto Yahweh and said, O Yahweh Elohim, destroy not your people and your inheritance, which you have redeemed through your greatness, which you have brought forth out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Look not unto the stubbornness of this people, nor to their wickedness, nor to their sin, lest the land whence you brought us up say, because Yahweh was not able to bring them into the land which he promised them, and because he hated them, he has brought them out to slay them in the wilderness. Yet they are your people and your inheritance, which you brought out by a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. So I finished the rest of the chapter because the theme of the rest of the chapter, the overriding theme is continuation from the first six verses where it says you don't deserve to go in the land. That he goes ahead and documents why the various things that they did to be rebellious, showing that he's going to bring you in for the purpose of the covenant that he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to show his faithfulness so that his name would be sanctified in the sight of the nations, so that the nations wouldn't say, he brought us out of Egypt, but he wasn't able to bring us in and to give us this land. And so, once again, we need to realize that when he takes us to greater places in him, the promised land, that it's not because we deserve it, because even the best of his servants still fails him in some form or fashion in their lives, in their service unto him. Open the floor up here for thoughts, questions, comments here in the congregation or in Pal Talk land. Anything that anyone would like to share here? Yes, Mark.
You know, doctors will tell you that you shouldn't fast for 40 days and 40 nights. You shouldn't fast from food and water. If you can only live without water for like 3 days, I think it is, something like that they keep telling us. Here's a guy that lived without it for 40 days and 40 nights. And then he turned around and did it again. Exactly right. Yeshua lived for 40 days and 40 nights without food or water. This is a foreshadowing of that. The fact is that if you are in the presence of Yahweh, he is your sustenance for both food and water. Okay? He provides you with the bread of life, and he provides you with the water of life, living water. So there isn't any need for the physical water and the physical bread. That's just an interesting thing. I mean, how do you live 40 days and 40 nights without bread or water? In the natural, it is impossible. It can only be done because Yahweh sustains them. Okay. So that's like Yahweh Yeshua in the wilderness. The day of the assembly. Assembly is the word kahal.
Now you're in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 10.
Verse 10, right. In the day of the assembly is the churches. It's the ecclesia, the kahal, the ecclesia, which is the church, the congregation, or the assembly.
Well, kahal is the Hebrew.
Right.
Ecclesia is the Greek equivalent.
Yes.
Which got translated into the New Testament as church. Go
right.
ahead.
Right. Now, it's interesting that ecclesia is the root word is kale, which sounds almost identical to kahal, so it probably came over from Hebrew to Greek. And it's just really interesting to me that ecclesia is a descendant probably of this word kahal that's used here, and it's translated as congregation, assembly, or church in all the English translations. Let's see. In verse 11, it came to pass at the end of 40 days, 40 nights, that Yahweh gave me two tables of stone, even the tables of the covenant. It's interesting. Mount Sinai is associated with the Torah written by the finger of Yahweh, while Zion is associated with the Torah written on our hearts by the Spirit of Yahweh. And so This is the difference, and you'll see it in Galatians, I think, in chapter 4, where it talks about Sarah and Hagar.
Yeah.
I think it's in Galatians 4.
Yes.
And it talks about the one is Mount Sinai, the other is Jerusalem, okay, or Mount Zion. So that's another way of looking at that. So I'm going to let that go for a while. You got anything, Bill?
Just a little bit here. When he was talking down in 19, he says, and I was afraid of the anger. Basically, the word there is alarmed. So whatever happened that he saw from Yahweh, if every word is not transcribed here, something there that really, really shook him up and bothered him, that he knew that they were going to, you know, destroy the people.
Yes.
And he pleaded for them. Another interesting thing, Eddie, that I was looking at here, I was looking at five words in this chapter. The first was understand. And then he says in 7, he says remember. Then he says furthermore in verse 13. Then he says likewise in verse 23. But in 29 he says yet. Five words, because of his grace. Five is grace. Mm-hmm. He says, I'm going to do this. Not because they deserve it, again, but it's because his plan and his purpose and his promise was going to be complete, and they weren't going to stop it.
Here in this chapter, of course, it's going over things that have happened in the past, among them being the building of the golden calf and Yahweh being upset. This comes from Exodus chapter 32, and where it says in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 21, I took your sin, the calf which you had made, and burned it with fire, and stamped it, and ground it very small, even until it was as small as dust, and I cast the dust to the brook that descended out of the mount. What he's doing here is ultimately what is going to be a part of what Yah gave to Moses regarding the test for a woman who is suspected of committing adultery, that the way in which Moses dealt to the children of Israel building the golden calf, he did it according to the specifications that the children of Israel were being adulterous in their relationship. And so let's see if we can find that. I believe it's in Numbers. In Numbers, in chapter 5, beginning in verse 11 through at the end of the chapter, this is called the Laws of Jealousies, or so it goes on to say, verse 17, the priest shall take holy water and of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water, and the priest shall set the woman before Yahweh and cover her head, and he will cause her to drink bitter water that that causes the curse, etc. And so it details these things here in Numbers chapter 5. Well, that was the penalty in the judgment, the behavior that was being given to the children of Israel because they built the golden calf. Yet, Moses interceded And Yahweh granted forgiveness to the people because of their behavior. And but ultimately then, those that participated in the golden calf, there was a judgment against them when Yahweh said, who's on his side? And the Levites came forward. Go ahead, Mark.
In verse 14, Yahweh says to Moshe, let me alone, in the King James. In the Tanakh, in the Stone's Tanakh, it says, release me. That's an interesting phrase. Why does Yahweh need to be released by Moshe? Okay. I think that the idea is that Yahweh had bound himself by his word that he would not destroy these people. And so he was asking for Moshe to release him from his word so that he could take these people out and raise up a people to Moshe. Now, that was not his intent. His intent was to test Moshe, and Moshe passed the test. But the idea that we could release Yahweh from his word is kind of telling to me. If we were to decide that we wanted to turn away from Yah, can we release him from his word that he would keep us? Thinking out loud.
The Strong's here. Number 7503, it's the Hebrew word rapha, and it says in the dictionary it means to slacken. It means to abate, cease, consume, fail, faint, be feeble, forsake, idle, leave, let alone, be still, be slothful. Uh-huh. And so that's why it was translated in the King James, let me alone, because it also has the meaning of forsaking and leaving. That's where you get the rendition of release. Mm-hmm. And so I don't view it that Yahweh is forsakes his word, but his blessings come from you being obedient unto it, and by not being obedient, you create the environment and the situation. So basically ties his hands. To prevent him from blessing you, even though he wants to bless you. And so he's being told, release me so I don't do it. The thought is, I'm not able to do it because of disobedience. You're tying my hands. Go ahead.
Sorry. That's all I had.
Okay, anything else that anyone would like to share regarding this chapter? Let's see what some of the comments are in the room. One comment is, focus needs to be placed on Yahweh instead of ourselves when we go through any difficult thing in life, because that's what gets us through. I think that's what he wants. And you know, that is an excellent point, because you know what happens when we focus on ourselves? Woe is me.
Oh, yeah.
And when we think about his faithfulness, then that gives us strength. So he does want us to look toward him when we go through difficult times, and that is what he wants from us in the lesson that we learn. Okay, anyone else with Numbers in chapter 9. Mark?
That's Deuteronomy in chapter 9.
I'm sorry, Deuteronomy.
Yes, I know you are.
It's not the first time that I, sometimes in my mind...
Yeah, you did it this morning too when you said that you were talking about the Shema in Deuteronomy chapter 4. But we won't go there.
Chapter 4 or chapter 6?
You said chapter 4.
Oh, okay.
You meant chapter 6 and verse 4, but that's okay.
I'm glad you were paying attention.
I pay attention to what I say.
I catch
this stuff, Eddie. I do. Anyway, I thought it was better to waste now and bust your chops about it
sometimes,
than interrupt you in the middle of the service.
Sometimes I listen to a tape or something that I'm saying, and I do what you know what you said. I'm thinking one thing, and I say another, and I got to listen to the tape to realize I said Romans instead of Hebrews or Hebrews instead of Romans.
Right. Okay. In verse 25, fell down before Yahweh 40 days and 40 nights, and I fell down as I fell down at the first, because Yahweh had said he would destroy you. Moshe has just been offered that his seed will be the promised seed. And what does he do? He falls down on his face to intercede for Israel. Rather than aggrandize himself, he humbled himself before Yahweh and said, no, you don't understand. If you do that, and you go down to verse 29, if you do that, then they won't see that your mighty power is what is bringing these people in. Yet they are a people of thine inheritance, which thou broughtest out by mighty power and by thy stretched out arm. Said he was more concerned with Yahweh's testimony than he was with his own aggrandizement again. Okay? He was more worried about the set apartness of Yahweh's name than he was with him becoming a great nation, himself becoming a great nation.
Also, we have to note that 40 is the number of trials.
Yes.
So, he went through a few of them. And when I got to thinking, I said, well, as much as he went through with the people, how much more Yahweh has done with the people and how he's still doing the trials and tribulations that cause him to anger and cause him to want to reject. But he still holds himself to his word. You know, we don't always do that, hold ourselves to the word we say, but he always does.
Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments? Like Mark pointed out, Moses was more concerned with the sanctification of the name of the God of Israel. It says in Psalm 103, verse 7, that the children of Israel knew the acts of God, but Moses knew his ways. And the reason why Moses was able to respond like he did was because he knew the ways of God. He knows that what God starts, he'll complete. He knows that what God promises, he will perform. And that he's holy and his name is to be sanctified in the earth through his people. And based upon principles, Moses was able to react and respond the way he did. Okay, we ready for the Haftorah, Yirmiyahu? Jeremiah chapter 3 and verses 1 and 2. They say, if a man puts away his wife and she go from him and become another man's, shall he return to her again? Shall not the land be greatly polluted? But you've played the harlot with many lovers, yet return again to me, says Yahweh. So the question that gets asked, if a man will put away his wife and she go from him and become another man, shall he return to her again? This goes back to what the Torah says in Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verses 1 through 4. And so, shall he return to her again? The answer is no. Shall the land be greatly polluted? The answer is yes. But you've played the harlot, yet return unto me. So he's asking a question
in the form of a parable. And he's saying, figure this one out. And so, of course, we know from Romans chapter 7, verses 1 through 4, that the answer to it is the only way Israel can return to the lawgiver and the bridegroom at Mount Sinai is for the lawgiver and the bridegroom to die, because his death severs the vows that were made. So he resurrects. When he resurrects, he makes a new covenant. And the one that we marry in Jerusalem is the new man. And the way you come to the new man is through his blood. So now verse 2, lift up your eyes in the high places and see where you've not been laid with. In the ways hast thou sat for them as the Arab being in the wilderness, and you have polluted the land with your whoredoms and with your wickedness. Verse 3, therefore the showers have been withholden, and there has been no latter rain, and you have a hoarse forehead, and you refused to be ashamed. Three verses, or actually two verses is really a part of our reading, but we read an extra verse there. Thoughts, questions, comments? Anything here? Go ahead.
I think it's when he's talking here, yet return again to me, I think that's the future event. The further fulfillment will be in the Messianic kingdom, because it talks about, I think, in Matthew 21, 43, talks about the stone that the builder rejected. Stone which the builders rejected, the same become the head of the corner. This is Yahweh's doing, and is marvelous in our sight. So we can't speak against it, because it is Yahweh's doing. It's His doing to do the things the way He's doing it, to fulfill His plan. If He's who He says He is, and He's sovereign, we should never question it.
The answer to these questions, in and of themselves, in verse 1, the first one is, okay, if a man put away his wife and she go away from him and become another man's, shall he return unto her again? The answer to that is no. He may not. Shall not that land be greatly polluted? The answer is yes, it shall. So how is it that Yahweh can tell them, return to me anyway? Okay, because he says right at the end of verse 2, no, I'm sorry, at the end of verse 1, it says, yet return again to me, saith Yahweh. I know that you played the harlot with many husbands, with many lovers, but return again to me. How can he receive her back? If you're Eddie's teaching on Shavuot, where he talks about the death that Yeshua died, the adulterous bride, in Romans chapter 7 and verses 1 through 4. That's how he can do it. And it's the only way. The answer to the first two questions is yes, and it shall. How can he allow her to come back? In order to take her back, Yahweh had to vicariously die the death of that faithless wife. He did this in his substitutionary atonement for her and rising from the dead to remarry her as a new man, which is a synopsis of Romans 7, 1 through 4. That's why he's sovereign. He can do as he pleases. That's right.
The other perplexing thing is that he is, when we're talking about the sovereignty of Yahweh, how he could do this, the same thing is, he says, don't make any idols. Yet, he put the serpent on the pole and said, look and live. That was an idol. But you see, if you don't get the fullness of it and have the understanding of it, why he did it. The serpent in the garden was one thing. This serpent was another thing. You see. But he's still sovereign. And he's the one who can do it.
Okay. Deuteronomy chapter 11, beginning in verse 8. And we're going to go over a principle of...
next week. Oh. I'm sorry.
Of going into the land.
and what you can expect to find there. It says, you shall keep all the commandments of this day, that you may be strong and go and possess the land where you go to possess it, that you may prolong your days in the land which Yahweh swore to your fathers to give unto them, to your seed, a land that flows with milk and honey. For the land where you go to possess is not as the land of Egypt, where you came out, where you sowed your seed and you watered it with your foot as a garden of herbs. That is a picture, or it can be a picture of a natural-minded believer. You're a believer, but you see life through, I got to go out and sow a seed and water it by my foot and it'll produce. That you see the natural cause and effect in your, you analyze your circumstances and your situation by natural cause and effect. This is in contrast to verse 11. But the land where you go to possess, it is a land of hills and valleys, and it drinks water of the rain of heaven. What does it mean that it drinks water of the rain of heaven? It means that you being able to be sustained and be blessed is dependent upon Him. And dependent upon His blessings is dependent upon your obedience. That's why He says, make sure you keep my commandments. It says a land that Yahweh your Elohim cares for. The eyes of it are always upon it from the beginning of the year even unto the end. That if you hearken diligently unto my commandments to love and to serve Him with all your heart, that I will give you the rain of your land in due season. The first rain and the latter rain, that you may go in and gather your corn, your wine, and your oil. So not only is there giants in the land, Not only is it dependent upon Him being faithful to His covenant promises, and for Him to be showing His faithfulness, His mercy, but the blessings that He provides to you is from Him through your heart, seeking to trust Him and to be obedient to His ways. That's how He blesses you in the promised land.
Notice something. They only show two seasons here. Sowing.
That's all there are.
And reaping. Basically, that's all there are.
Yeah. So now that goes back to Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 3, that now you take the opposite. That when you are being in disobedient, the showers and the rain is being hidden from you.
Yeah, that's the first thing. That's one of the first things that happens when you go into disobedience, is he withholds the rain that brings your crops out of the ground. You can go ahead and sow all you like. It's not going to do you any good because there's not enough rain. Kind of like what happened this year in northern Ohio.
Sort of like you sow all that you want. In other words, I'm going to do that. I'm going to try this. I'm going to do that. But nothing comes of any benefit because he's not raining upon it. His blessings not coming with it. Go ahead, Mark.
Okay. Well, I'm looking in the text, and I see that Servant 60 asked a good question. It says here, bait, doesn't the bride have to be renewed, not just a new man? Well, yes, that is true. But there are two parts to the wedding ceremony. We've been over that a couple of times. I'm sure you've heard it. There's the betrothal period, which is the one that we're in right now, in which we are not the bride. I mean, we're technically the bride, but we're not the bride. The
betrothed,
bride is taken. We're in the betrothal period.
But
that's
we're
right.
Not actually completing things.
Right. In the resurrection, we will become the bride. Okay. Those of us that overcome will become the bride, and at that point, we are given new bodies, and therefore we will not sin again. Okay, so at that particular point, is when the bride really comes to fruition. At the point right now, the new man can now take us as his betrothed because he's died that death for us in our place, and now he can, being resurrected as a new man, he can his former bride that he has divorced. And he can take her as a betrothal. And that's what we're in right now, is a betrothal period.
And the bride will be pure.
The bride will be absolutely pure. She's going to be given a new body. That answer the question there, servant 60?
Okay. So, the time of the kingdom and the resurrection that's associated with it is where we have the marriage, and we ultimately, if you want to look at it this way, fulfill the fullness of being and becoming his bride and being a faithful bride. All right. Any other thoughts, questions, comments regarding Jeremiah chapter 3 and the first several verses there of it? Anything that anyone would like to...
Yeah, I love the King James, the way that some of the words that it uses. It uses words that are out of use anymore, kind of out of use. We got this word lane, L-I-E-N, which means that you laid down with every idol there was, basically, is what he's telling Israel or Judah at this time. And he's talking to Judah, by the way, not to the whole house of Israel. So, lift up your eyes unto the high places. What other high places are doing in Judah? Well, they're there because they're worshiping false gods. So look up at the high places and see where you have not lain, whom you have not lain with. Okay? Any? Are there any? I don't see any that you haven't lain with. All right? It says, in the ways thou hast sat for them as the Arabian in the wilderness. You're lying in wait for another idol to come along so that you can lay down with him too. Right? You have polluted the land with your whoredoms and with your wickedness. Guess why it was that Judah was going to be going into captivity, into Babylon? I'll tell you why. It's because they were following after idols. Now, you know what? We may not be following after idols per se, but you know, if you got a television in your house, more than likely, all the chairs are surrounding it. Okay? And they're all facing towards that television. Or, you know, if maybe you don't have a television, but instead you've got an internet and you've got a computer every waking moment on that thing. Okay? Where is your allegiance? Is it to Yahweh? Do you spend as much time with him as you do looking at this crap? Pardon the French. I mean, really and truly. Where is your time spent?
If you want to do away with those things that you shouldn't be doing, then you'll do a French fry.
A French?
Because you said, pardon my French. And so,
oh, yes.
So if you get away with, if you get away with the idols, then you'll take the idols and do away with it. You'll do a French fry.
There you go. See that? He's so fortunate that he's behind me and I'd have to walk around the desk to get to him. Okay. Anyway, that's all I've got there. Okay, when we see ourselves and our sin as Yahweh sees us and it, we will repent and turn to him. Okay, so we need to be looking at it and try to see it from his point of view and see our lives from his point of view. Somebody said what? Is us. That's exactly right. The biggest idol that Mark has to fight is Mark.
It's a little word called ego.
Yeah.
Everybody has an ego.
Yeah.
Problem.
Yeah. You're an ego there. That's right. Yeah, you're exactly right. And that's the hardest one to overcome. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Any other thoughts, questions, comments? All right. Psalm 127, 5 verses. Except Yahweh build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except Yahweh keep the city, the watchman wakes but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he gives his beloved sleep. Lo, children are a heritage of Yahweh, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are the children of the youth. Happy is the man that has quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gates. Except Yahweh build the house, they labor in vain that build it. You know, if whatever you're seeking and attempting to do in your life, if Yah is not leading and guiding and directing you in it, and if He isn't central of it, then in the end, what you do ends up becoming vanity and for naught. Go ahead, Mark.
Notice that the opening, the heading for this thing is A Song of Degrees for Solomon. This is something that was written by David for Solomon. And when it says, when he builds a house, you labor in vain who build it, unless Yahweh builds a house, he's talking about the house of Yahweh. He's talking about the temple in Jerusalem, Solomon's temple. Okay, if it's not Yahweh that's behind that thing, then you're laboring in vain.
Do you think this was put right in the middle of the 15 songs?
Yes, sir. It certainly is.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
Well, what Bill's referring to is Psalm 120 to Psalm 134. It's called the Psalms of Ascent. So this is basically in the middle of the Psalms of Ascent. And Mark is exactly right. In context, this is David communicating to Solomon. Now, I'm not going to build the temple. You are. But it's only when Yah builds the house that it has merit. But if Yah doesn't build the house, then your labors are in vain.
Yep.
Anybody else?
Yeah, what we're going to build isn't going to last for very long. It's temporal. But what Yahweh builds is forever. And that's the idea here. He builds in our lives. What He builds in our lives is forever. What we build in our lives is going to die. It's going to burn.
Now,
all this money spent for naught. I mean, look at all the money that I've spent on my good looks. My goodness. Lost money already.
You need to spend more.
Amen.
Yeah. Those that have met Mark and I think the one comment was that he said they've heard us on the air and didn't know we were as ugly as we were. That sort of brings you down, you know. I think that I like this part here. It said, even if you rise up early,
yeah,
or if you set up late, and if you eat the bread of sorrow, what does it mean? It doesn't mean anything.
It says you know. Are not ugly.
Oh, boy. But I think it's a good psalm to set right in the middle, that David is trying to tell his son, consider this. Consider what I'm telling you right here. Before you go any further, you know, it's like saying to him, Selah. You know, and I think that this is what he's trying to project to him. I could be wrong here, though.
Well, if David's telling Solomon that the children are a fruit of the womb and a blessing from Yahweh, Solomon took that one to heart pretty good, didn't he?
Oh, boy, did he.
Yeah, boy.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, one can be so diligent and be obedient to Yah and He can bless you. I'm talking materially. Then you hand over your blessings to the next generation. And if that next generation has worldly thinking, gets involved in worldly practices and worldly ways, it's so easy for that material blessing to be gone.
Yes, doesn't take long.
That unless Yah builds a house, He who builds, builds in vain. That what you're doing in your labors actually becomes not. And that kind of goes with Haggai. The book of Haggai in chapter 1. And if we can find and read that, that would be Haggai in chapter 1. Did anyone beat me to it? Would I say, if Solomon had 1,000 wives, I would think that he would have had thousands of children. So.
You're looking for what, Haggai?
Yeah,
And here it is.
Here it is. We found it. It appeared. Haggai chapter 1, verse 3. Then came the word of Yahweh by Haggai the prophet, saying, "Is it time for you to dwell in your sealed houses and this house lie waste? Now therefore, thus says Yahweh, consider your ways. You've sown much, you bring in little. You eat, but you have not enough. You drink, but you are not filled with drink. You clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earns wages to put it into a bag with holes. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountain and bring wood and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, says Yahweh. You looked for much, and lo, it came to little. And when you brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why, says Yahweh of hosts, because of my house that is in waste, and you run every man into your own house. Therefore the heaven over you is stayed from dew, and the earth is stayed from her fruits." So therefore what he's saying is, you're doing all these labors, and you're not laboring to build my house. Therefore I'm not blessing you in your labors. And you want to be blessed in your labors? Then consider my house. Consider my ways. Consider my kingdom. Consider the things that please me. That if you will set your heart after those things, then I will bless you in the things you do. But notice, when you set your heart to those things, he's going to bring you into a land where there's giants in the land. Mm-hmm. Right. That it's a land of hills and valleys. And your relationship with Yah and your dependence on his provision still ends up being the mercy and the blessing that he bestows and he puts upon you. Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comment regarding Psalm 127?
You know, Eddie, what you said about the hills and the valleys reminds me of Jacob when he was on the mountain, then when he was in the valleys.
Go ahead, Mark.
Okay. Children are an heritage unto Yahweh, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. We do not need to sit up nights trying to dream up new ways to bring people into our congregation. Just keep doing what Yahweh would have you do, and let him draw in the people to learn and to teach us. Let Yahweh build the kahal, is what that is. It's all about building the house. Children are a heritage unto the Lord. If you can't lead them, breed them. If you can't lead them to the kingdom, hey, you got kids. Lead them to the kingdom. And my wife and I have been incredibly fortunate that all four of our kids are following Yah in one way or another.
Very fortunate.
So, yeah, very fortunate indeed.
I don't believe in luck. Fortunate is a better word, and
yeah,
a blessing.
It's really the same thing, but fortunate is a nicer way to put it. Yeah, I don't believe in luck either. Yahweh is our good fortune. So,
anything else before we go to the Brit Hadashah, which is Colossians?
Ephesians.
No, it's Ephesians. See, thank
Ephesians
you.
Ephesians 2,
1 through 3, 6.
You've been way too long.
Ephesians chapter 2 and then chapter 3 verses 1 through 6. So Ephesians chapter 2. And you has he quickened who were dead.
Eddie, for just a second.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just want you all to notice the pronouns that Paul uses here and how they're used. When he says you, he's talking directly to the Ephraimites. When he says us or we, he's talking about us Jews. And later on in the thing, it's going to get to the where now you are a common part of the Commonwealth of Israel. And when he says us and we, he's talking about the entire Kahal. Okay, so I'm sorry, I wanted a heads up on that.
Well, that's very good. So now we're going to read it with that in mind. And you has he quickened who were dead in trespasses and sins. So if this is referring to the northern kingdom, right, because they broke the covenant, right?
Right.
No mercy, not my people, Hosea 1. Where in time past you walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit now works in the children of disobedience. The children of disobedience do what? They don't follow the Torah. Among whom also we all had our conversations in time past in the lusts of our flesh and fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature the children of wrath, even as others. But Elohim, who is rich in mercy, so notice he connects it with mercy. Hosea chapter 1, those who were no mercy, not my people, they're going to be my people, and he's going to show them mercy. But God, who is rich in mercy for his great love, where he has loved us, even we were dead in sins, that means breaking the Torah, he has quickened us together with Messiah, and he's raised us up together and made us sit together in heavenly places. So based on what Mark's saying, when he's using he's raised us, that is through the work of Messiah, he's brought together, redeemed, the 10 tribes of Ephraim along with Judah, and together, redeemed in Messiah, who we were formerly dead in our trespasses and sin, but he's raised us up and caused us to sit together in heavenly places. Go ahead.
The way I actually read it is that when he says us, he's talking about Judah. Okay? At least at this point in this thing, he's talking about Judah, and he's talking about Ephraim when he says you. When he's talking to the second person, he's talking to the 10 northern tribes that are out dispersed in the world. And Judah is talking about when he says us. He's talking about himself and his other brethren among Judah. And as we get further into this thing, when we get past verse 10, that's when he starts to tie together how the Ephraimites and the Judahites get together, and they're all part of the Commonwealth of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? This is the way that I read this, and I could be wrong, but that's the way that I see it up to this point. That's the way he does it in Romans anyway.
Let's continue.
Okay, we got a question.
Got a question,
Ed. Okay.
What is it, Liz?
It says, why did you skip by grace?
We haven't skipped anything.
We haven't made it to that verse yet.
Is there sound just came in and can't hear, she says.
There is sound, and we're in verse 5, right, Ephesians chapter 2. So we haven't gotten to their grace by, saved by grace through faith.
So verse 5, even when we were dead in sins, he's quickened us together with Messiah. By grace are you saved, and he's raised us up together and made us sit together in heavenly places in Messiah Yeshua, that in the ages to come he might show the exceedingly riches of his grace and his kindness toward us through Messiah Yeshua. For by grace are you saved through faith, and that of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Messiah Yeshua unto good works, which God has before ordained that we should walk in them. You want to stop there with thoughts, questions, comments?
That's where the paragraph ends. That's a good place to stop. Up to this point, he's talking to the... basically, he's talking to the Ephraimites, the northern kingdom, the Gentiles in Ephesus, which is probably the much larger portion of the of the Kahal at that point in Ephesus. There were a few Jews in Ephesus. There were a whole bunch of Gentiles. And that's the way I see that. So he's referring to when he says us and we at the beginning of this chapter, he's talking mostly about the Jews. And when he's talking about you, he's talking about the Ephraimites. And if you look at how that goes, I mean, it's incredible how many times he uses these pronouns. And he very seldom uses a noun to talk about any of them. But it says, wherefore, in verse 11, it says, wherefore be mindful that you formerly were carnal Gentiles. Okay? That's where I get this whole idea. He's talking to you. He's talking to the Gentiles. Notice in verse 8 and 9, it says, for it is by his grace we are rescued, is what it says in the Aramaic English New Testament. It says in the King James, it says, for it is by grace are ye saved through faith. He says, we were saved by grace. And then this is not of yourselves, but it's a gift of El. Now he's at this particular point. He's using that "we" as both. He's starting to do the transition from talking about the two houses apart, and now he's talking about the two houses together. By grace are we saved through faith, or rather, in this case, he says rescued, which the note tells me that that rescued is actually a better word than saved. And this not of yourselves; it's a gift of Elohim. The gift, when opened, this is a note from the Aramaic English New Testament. This gift, when opened, teaches us of his wisdom and knowledge and instructs us by revealing his character of love. The gift of grace brings us to an understanding of his goodness, but also brings guilt because our ways are not his ways. This leads us to repentance, which gives birth to faith. Grace, then, is the character of Mashiach that is righteousness imparted to his followers, as in Romans chapter 5, verses 17 to 21. It's also interesting to note that the synonym for the gift of Yahweh is the name Matityahu, or Matthew. Okay? Rav Shaul perhaps intended to reference Matthew here, the writer of the first account of the Good News. Matthew's account of the Good News might well have been the only extant copy of the Gospel, okay, of the life of Messiah at this particular time. So that's why he makes that comment. But opening the gift is the important thing. You know, you can get a gift and not open it, and it's not, you know, it's does you no good. You don't have any idea what's in that gift.
When you see this, that we're saved by grace, it says through faith. Faith is the channel through which grace flows through.
That is correct.
And makes... It really makes both of them gifts.
Yes, and you know, and you know what else? The word faith doesn't necessarily mean just your belief. It doesn't necessarily mean just your belief.
Right.
It also has to do with the actions that come as a result of that belief, and that's what verse 10 is all about, where we works that God has before ordained that we should walk in them. Where did He before ordain that?
In the Torah.
That's right.
Obedience is the walk.
That's right. Okay. He's before ordained.
And James will tell you all about the works.
And again, when he uses the word "we" in this particular case, he's talking about the Jews, okay? Because the Gentiles had no idea of this until just a few months or maybe years before. There isn't any way that the Gentiles would have known that God ordained that we should walk in these ways. They couldn't have known what the ways were. That's one of the reasons that I see that way, along with the fact that he does that all through Romans. Talks about you talking to Gentiles and us talking about the Jews.
Okay.
All I got for now.
Else? Thoughts, questions, comments? Verse 11, wherefore remember that you being in time past Gentiles in the flesh who were called uncircumcision. See, when the northern kingdom got cut off from the covenant in Hosea chapter 1, no mercy, not my people, lo ruhama lo ami, their spiritual condition was uncircumcised. Uncircumcised meaning cut off from the covenant. By that which is called the circumcision, the flesh made by hands, that at that time when you were uncircumcision, that you were without Messiah, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope, and without Elohim in the world. You know, Mark, that he is talking about the northern kingdom, because in verse 13,
absolutely,
he says, but now in Messiah Yeshua, you who were far off,
that's right,
which is a reference to the northern kingdom, Daniel
that's
chapter
right.
9, verse 7, near by the blood of Messiah, he is our peace.
That's right. Now he's talking about, yeah, okay, go ahead.
He's our peace, who has made both one.
Yeah, right. And that's where you start to see the real connection of the two houses of Israel and Judah.
He's broken down the middle wall of partition, having abolished in his flesh the enmity.
Mm-hmm.
The enmity was a couple ways. Between Northern Kingdom and Southern Kingdom, there was enmity.
Mm-hmm.
But there was enmity between them and the Almighty because they broke the covenant.
Right. There was enmity between the northern and southern kingdoms from almost from the time that they left Egypt. That had to do with a lot of different things, including, number one, Jacob calling Ephraim his firstborn. That caused some pride in Ephraim. Joshua taking them into the promised land, being a Ephraimite. Okay, another thing that caused pride in Ephraim. The fact that Benjamin came from and Ephraim followed after him. And Judah was led by David and two different kingdoms were set up. And it was only in David's kingdom, another reference to Messiah, by the way, only in David's kingdom that all 12 tribes were together under one head. There's some incredible stuff to be seen there.
So it says he abolished in his flesh the enmity, the law of commandments in ordinances. The word ordinances is dogma.
That's correct, dogma, not Torah truth.
Right.
Dogma is man-made.
Right. For to make in himself of the two one new man. The one new man is in Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
So making peace. And that he might reconcile both unto God in one body by the cross, having slain the enmity. And he came and preached shalom to you who were far off. That would be the northern kingdom. And to them that are near, that would be the southern kingdom. For through him we both have access by one Spirit unto the Father. Now therefore you are no more strangers and foreigners. How were they strangers and foreigners? Because they were cut off from the covenant. Hosea chapter 1. But you are fellow citizens with the saints, the righteous ones, the holy ones, and of the household of God. And you are built upon the foundation of the sent ones, the apostles, shaliachs, and prophets, Yeshua HaMashiach being the chief corner. In other words, him being the chief prophet and apostle.
Correct.
Because among other things, Yeshua walked in the office of prophet and apostle among...
Yes, he did. Yes, he did, and he's the
others.
One. He's the cornerstone that holds the two, the prophets and the apostles, together.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
In whom all the building, fitly framed together, grows into a holy temple in Yahweh, in whom we also are built together for a habitation of God through the Ruach. So he's talking about the role of Messiah. He's writing to the northern kingdom. He's talking about the role of Messiah to bring together Ephraim and Judah, make him one new man through his death on the tree by bringing shalom. And now he's given us his spirit. We have access to his spirit. We are a part of his body. This is what Paul's explaining. He's explaining the work of Messiah to those of the northern kingdom in Ephesus. Go ahead.
Okay, I got a couple of things here that I this is also coming from the Aramaic English New Testament in the notes. Like I told you before, if you don't like the translation of this thing, the notes are worth the cost of admission. Anyway, the covenant of the promise, strangers to the covenant of the promise, aliens from the regulations of Israel is what it says here. Here's what this says. It says, the Greek reads strangers to the commonwealth of Israel. The Aramaic reads strangers to the regulations of Israel and to the covenant of the promise. Yahweh identifies Israel according to her obedience to Torah as those who keep covenant rather than after the flesh. The renewed covenant in Jeremiah 31 and Hebrews 8 is first made with Israel and Judah and then offered to others from the nations who choose to live in obedience to the covenant. Furthermore, it is a very interesting admission. Translator John Wesley Etheridge translates Dubori de Israel here as polity of Israel rather than the regulations or the covenant of Israel. Okay? But adds in his footnotes regarding this phrase the manners or regulations of Israel. In other words, he's looking at the nation's divorcement from the intricate rules of Israel and not some obscure moral distillation of Torah as a bad thing. This reading even goes beyond my own rendering of citizenship of Israel, but I believe the point is the same. If the Ephesians are citizens of Israel, then they are subject to her regulations as well. Okay, so if they're citizens of the Commonwealth of Israel, then they must also follow Torah. That's the truth. Now, the talks about the wall of separation. The Aramaic for wall is sayaga. Ironically, this exact term was picked by the Talmudic rabbis in Pirkei Avot 1:1, in where they say, make a fence around the Torah. So the middle wall of partition could very well be the fence that the rabbis are building around Torah. Okay? Not just the partition between Israel and Judah, between the Gentiles and the believers.
The courtyard of the Gentiles too.
Right, the courtyard of the Gentiles as well. That wall, by the way, is not in the temple. What do you call it? It's not supposed to be in the temple. God didn't put it there. Yes, man did. Okay.
Can I throw another thought
sure, go
here
ahead.
That maybe that there were one where Yahweh put so that the Jews could not go into the holy place or the holy of holies. And when Yeshua died, he broke that open. So he separated. He also broke down the wall between Jews and Gentiles.
Yes, absolutely.
And he broke down the walls from the Jews unto the holy of holies to himself.
Yes. He not only did he take down the fence that surrounded the Torah so that we can't get to it, he took down the wall of enmity between Jew and Gentile. He also took down the wall of enmity between himself and us.
That's exactly what I had.
All at the same time. Absolutely correct. That is absolutely correct. Yeshua specifically warned against this activity in Matthew chapter 15, rebuking the Pharisees in the process, talking about building a wall, a fence around the Torah. Mm-hmm. Later on, Yeshua said that he was the door or the gate, using a synonym for siaga, known as ta'areya, which is a homonym, Torah and teachers, meaning the Pharisees. So while the Pharisees were busy erecting their fence, Yeshua is pulling it down, allowing everyone access. Okay.
Well, the rabbis definitely do not encourage everyone to have access to the Torah. They want it to be just for them. But Yeshua broke that down. What? He is the lawgiver. We have a Pow Talk comment from Ephesians 2:15, and the comment is regarding having abolished in his flesh the enmity, even the law of commandments contained in ordinances. The comment is, I don't think this means he abolished dogma.
I think this means that by the Spirit of God, we will walk in God's ways. No longer will our flesh and our spirit be at enmity with each other, with not obeying the commandments of God.
Yeah, could very well be. The enmity is that, that means that you've become an enemy to something. Okay? Enmity is making your, is something that makes you an enemy. Okay, so we became enemies to Yahweh when we decided to sin. And when we decided to follow Him, the enmity was removed. And, enmity is spoken of later on as he nailed it to his tree. Okay? And nailing the enmity to the tree had nothing to do with nailing the Torah to the tree, because Torah didn't cause enmity. Our sin caused enmity. Torah is not the opposite of grace. Torah and grace work together. What is the opposite of grace is our sin. What is the opposite of following Torah is our sin. And so it's our sin that causes the enmity. Okay, so that is what is nailed to the tree, is our sin, not Torah. And that's someplace that the church has just refused to go, is to look at it properly. Romans talks about...
Hey, we're ready to go to Ephesians 3, 1 through 6. For this cause, I, Paul, the prisoner of Yeshua HaMashiach, for you Gentiles, who's going to be the northern kingdom.
Yeah, the cause that he's talking about is them becoming a part of the Commonwealth of Israel.
Right. If you had heard of the dispensation of the grace of God, which is given me to you word, how that by revelation he made known unto me the mystery, as I wrote afore in few words, whereby when you read you may understand my knowledge in the mystery of Messiah, which in other ages was not made known unto the sons of men, as it is now revealed unto his holy apostles and prophets by the Spirit, that the Gentiles should be fellow heirs and of the same body and partakers of his promise of Messiah by the gospel. In other words, the Bible message was always, even though Northern Kingdom in this case would break the covenant, the prophets all prophesied about the restoration to come. That restoration to come is through the Messiah, so that in being restored, the whole house of Jacob would be one body, and would be fellow heirs. And so Paul is explaining, as Mark pointed out in his comment, that Paul understands that his calling and the reason for the revelation that he has of Messiah, which he says came by the Spirit, that he is now teaching and explaining, that he is committing himself to this task of laying down his life as a bondservant to proclaim Messiah to those of the northern, in this case, in this letter, who are in Ephesus. So that's what I see here. Other thoughts, questions, comments?
Eddie, I heard a preacher a few years ago, and he made a statement from the pulpit that that Paul was the one that was to reveal this message of the mystery of this enlightenment that Yeshua didn't even know. Now, how can you make a statement like that when it follows down here and it tells us that the prophets and the apostles knew and they were teaching it? I think they're being misled to the fact it was a mystery because some were not to know, just like the parables. They were a mystery to people because it wasn't for them to know, mainly because of their heart.
Well, perhaps what he's saying is that which the prophets wrote about is now being revealed to be and understood in a greater clarity by the Spirit. Perhaps that is one of the points which he's trying to make. You have anything to share here, Mark, on these verses?
The King James has the word dispensation in verse 2 of chapter 3, the dispensation of his grace. When he's talking about dispensation there, he's not talking about dispensationalism.
Yeah.
Okay, he's talking about giving it out.
Right.
Okay? Okay, he's dispensing grace, all right? Yeah. And it has become a doctrine of the church that there are dispensations, different dispensations of grace, different times in which grace is given in different ways. And that's a load of hooey. Hooey, that means it stinks. Hoo-wee! You know. So
let's get rid of it and make it a French fry.
Let's get rid of it and make it a French fry. There you go. I wouldn't like that French fry. That would not be nice. A better translation of that word in language that we would understand is stewardship of grace. Okay? Stewardship is a much better translation of that word, given the false doctrine that has become dispensationalism.
Look at what we have in the dictionary. That's 3622. And 3622 says it means it does say that it means stewardship.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the alternative renderings of the meaning.
The literal
of the word.
Translation is administration.
Administration. Administration. Stewardship is administration. So.
Correct.
Disperse can be seen as dismissed because I'm giving you responsibility, so I'm dispersing or granting you.
Yes.
But really, a better English word that better communicates the understanding is stewardship.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. At least, dispensation is not a bad word.
No.
Okay? And it wasn't a bad it is not a bad translation of this word at all. It's what has been done with it, okay, in creating the dispensations, the different dispensations, which it's that is the load of hooey. Okay? So I really don't have a problem with the King James, but you have to understand what the words say and not put it through the filter of false theology. Another question? Oh, yeah. Okay,
anybody else here in the congregation or in Pow Talk have any further thoughts, questions, comments regarding Ephesians chapter 2 through chapter 3, verses 1 through 6? Anything they'd like to share? You have a final thought, Mark, or no?
Not really. I think we pretty well covered it. I'm sure that I could find 7 or 8 more things to say about verse 1. But
I'm sure we all could. But we got the gist of it that he's writing to the Northern Kingdom, explaining them the work of Messiah done unto them and how Messiah has redeemed them, and now they've joined Judah as a part of the family of God and are a part of his body that through the way and by the Spirit, this has all been made possible. Well, if you have no other thoughts, questions, comments,
We pray that the Midrash has been a blessing to you. It's helped you in your studies. It's allowed you to draw closer to Yeshua and understanding the kingdom and the ways of his kingdom and the principles of his kingdom. Until we do it again, Shalom in Yeshua the Messiah. Amen.